They're coming to get you, Barbara. You're still afraid.
Stop it! You're ignorant!
Hello, welcome to Night of the Living Academic. I'm Caitlin, and I welcome all horror films into my heart with open arms, even the misfit ones.
And this is your co-host, Matt, and I have a thing called standards.
And today we are talking about the 2009 film Jennifer's Body, directed by Karen Kusama.
Yeah, and also written by Diablo Cody, which I think is an important thing to mention when we talk about something that when a writer comes in as strong as this, but we'll talk about all that. So one thing before we get started on this is why we chose Jennifer's Body. We didn't discuss it at the end of our last podcast of our selection, but it does seem that there's been a lot of chatter about this movie lately, right?
Yeah, in the last, like, 3 years or so, it's sort of getting a return or, like, or people are trying to reclaim it a little bit. Right. Yeah, and it makes sense, I think, and we'll talk about this more, but I think it makes sense why this movie is more appreciated today, starting around 2018.
Post-Me Too movement.
Yeah, post-Me Too movement than it was back in 2009 for a lot of reasons, but I think also just sort of where we culturally are right now.
Right.
I think this movie maybe was a bit ahead of its time, and it just makes more sense now.
And as far as, like, Reddit, for example, not only is this movie getting talked about, but I think on the heels of this, people are not talking about Ginger Snaps, which I heard was a similar movie.
Ginger Snaps is really good, too. I was actually more of a fan of Ginger Snaps back in the day that I was of this one.
Got it.
But I don't know now. I need to rewatch Ginger Snaps because now I feel like I love Jennifer's Body more.
I think we should watch it together. We don't have to do a whole episode about it, but just the nice pairing.
We might want to.
Yeah, but you know what? This is getting way too much into conversation about the movie when we first should have talked about some horror news. I don't think there's anything upcoming that we want to speak about.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. But
although I will say, actually, I'm excited. The Salem Horror Fest, it's going to be virtual this year, so we can actually attend for once. Normally, I've wanted to go to the Salem Horror Fest for a while now, but hotels and Airbnb fill up pretty fast out there around Halloween, so we haven't gotten a chance to ever go. So I'm actually very excited to see that this fall, to be there, if not physically, virtually.
Yeah, I'm excited too. And maybe we'll get some of our listeners, we'll meet up in person over there. We'll have a little breakout channel or something.
Sure.
So other than that news, it seems like we do want to talk about a couple things we've had finished up watching in terms of other media, mostly TV series at this point. So anything on the top of your mind, Caitlin?
Well, I guess, I mean, this is going to come out later, but I recently just finished watching Umbrella Academy.
Ah.
And you sort of did. It was on in the background while you played video games.
Yeah, I did not like the first season at all, and I don't think it's a good show. I'm sorry.
But I enjoy it. I actually think this season may have been better than the first one.
Right.
But I don't really remember the first one that well, so I'm hesitant to make that claim.
I will say, I, you know, chimed in from time to time. And, you know, just have it on in the background pretty much. It's like it's not like I was out of the room. It was always on when I was in the room. And it seemed way more coherent than the first season. Because I remember the first season jumping into many different points of views and different characters. Like, you know, you have the whole entire thing with Cha-Cha and Hazel.
Who were the best characters.
Who were the best characters, but also had nothing to do with anything, really. So this seemed way more streamlined, at least from a casual point of view. And you know what, Caitlin? I'm about to set some listeners out there by saying, I don't understand why anybody thinks Five, this little kid, is any good. I mean, I
agree. He's the worst part of this entire show.
I really don't want to go at this child actor, right? Although right now he's probably in his tweens.
And he's definitely not listening to this anyway.
Yeah. But I don't want people to hate on him. I just hate people's reactions to him.
Mm-hmm.
I think he is doing as adequate a job as a average child actor is.
Sure.
But people are lauding him, maybe because his writing is, I don't know, his character is dumb. I think the acting's annoying.
The character was destined to be an annoying character as performed by an actual tween.
Yeah.
I bet in the comics it's probably fine because it's just, you know, a comic and you just read it with your adult brain.
Right.
But when you have to actually see a tween act like an older man. It's very frustrating and annoying
right,
to me.
Right, right. So just for context, people not watching it, it's basically this character who is like a 75-year-old, well-seasoned assassin living in a 12...
Well, I think he's like in his 50s.
Okay. But like a 13-year-old's body, but this kid, so who's obviously like within that age range, is acting like the seasoned assassin. But he picks up these really weird mannerisms, like what he considers old man mannerisms, but it's not even the case.
No,
and it makes it even seem really stupid when we actually get to see him as an old man, played by an old man character, who has zero of those mannerisms.
Spoilers!
Sorry, I'm just so... I don't understand the fandom around this, why people are rallying, saying that he's doing a fantastic job. I think it's one of the most cringeworthy performances I've ever seen. And again, I don't necessarily blame the actor, this kid actor. I blame everyone around him encouraging him to act this, and adults not telling him, no, this is dumb.
Yeah, I think the main thing, if I were a director of one or all of those episodes, what I wish the director would say to him is that right now his performance is constantly in this one note, and he needs to vary his line readings a lot. Because right now, every single line is read in the same exact way, and that's what's frustrating about it. I think to say something nice about Umbrella Academy, I really like Claus a lot. I always like Claus. He's the most fun.
He's fun. I think.
I mean, I miss Cha-Cha and I forget Hazel.
Cha-Cha. I think Cha-Cha and Hazel were the best written characters and best performing characters. And Pogo. I think Claus is...
Claus is fun.
I don't know. I think his character is a little destined to be overwritten and overperformed. It's one of those, I don't know, Jack Sparrow ripoff type performances that we're getting we're seeing far too much of nowadays.
Fair enough.
All right. So any other...
I enjoyed watching it. I know it's not the smartest of shows, but it's a very comforting show.
Yeah, only because let's see if you would be watching this if Gerard didn't originally write the series. I wonder if that would be the case.
Well, I think that's also why I'm annoyed with this child actor, because he got to go in a very nice box seat or balcony seat and watch the MCR comeback.
Yeah.
And I didn't get to do it, and he did just because he's in Umbrella Academy. That's very frustrating to me.
Oh, it's probably because Gerard wants to see a young Frankie Arrow.
Ugh, right? No. Anyway.
Oh, that's based on. Okay, other than that, I think the only one other show we have completed is, I don't even remember, it's a Netflix documentary series.
Oh, it's like New York City versus the Mafia, or maybe New York versus the Mafia.
All I can remember is the same kind of production team that did Don't Fuck with Cats, which I thought was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And this one's more self-contained, but worth the watch. I think it's only about 3 hours. Just fun seeing how we actually took down the Mafias back in the 80s. In New York City.
Unfortunately, it places Rudy Giuliani. Whoa. It places Giuliani in the seat of like a hero, which I don't love.
Well, I mean, yeah, but at the same time,
get him out of here.
He is somewhat unanimously heralded as someone who did fight the mob pretty well.
Anyway, I also enjoyed listening to the audio recordings they had of real mafia guys. That was fun.
Yeah, well, we recommend it, A Little True Crime Divergence, which is, of course, horror adjacent, but fun nonetheless. All right, so let's jump into discussing Jennifer's Body. I got a synopsis here. Anything to talk about before I jump into that, Caitlin?
That's it. Give us that plot summary.
Okay, so Jennifer's Body, made in 2009, and as we mentioned, it's directed by Karen Kurosawa and written by Diablo Cody. And she was somewhat fresh off the success of Juno, that 2007 hit. And it stars Amanda Seyfried as Needy, a somewhat plain Jane high schooler who just happens to be best friends with Jennifer, their class's popular sex kitten, and of course she is played by Megan Fox. After a strange visit from a rising indie rock band, or actually, rising might not be the best way to describe it, but
pretty,
a small-time indie rock band.
At that point.
I'll go ahead and cut right to the chase and just say that Jennifer is turned into a succubus, and she must feed on people to maintain her strength.
And her beauty.
And so as she preys on this town, of course, Needy knows the truth, sees the truth, and she must turn on her former best friend, despite having her own lingering attractions to Jennifer. So, I know that's not exactly, you know, the whole plot of the movie, but as a synopsis, Caitlin, anything you want to add to that?
Oh, that that's about it. I mean, I guess what happens to Needy at the end, spoilers, Needy kills Jennifer.
Yep.
And she's put into like a criminally, like a...
mental institution, yeah.
Yeah, for the criminally insane,
right.
I think.
But she does end up absorbing some of this demonic power that Jennifer has without being a demon / succubus herself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So, Caitlin, overall thoughts?
I really liked it, as I said. So, I first saw this when it came out in theaters back in 2009. I remember I didn't really think too much about it. I feel like I just saw it and that was it. Like, I left the theater and it was gone from my brain pretty much immediately. I remember thinking it was fun. I was an OC fan, so seeing Adam Brody in like a villainous role was really fun.
As a lead singer for this rising indie rock band,
mm-hmm.
small time indie rock band, yep.
And Low Shoulder, I believe they're called.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, that's about it. Besides that, it's a real blank space. But watching it this time around, I thought it was really fun. It almost feels like a nostalgic time capsule for the early 2000s, especially if you were into like the emo or indie rock scene back then. There's certainly a lot of that in the styles and the music. The soundtrack is really fun. Although, I guess, for the most part, the soundtrack is this fake song from Low Shoulder. But it's not a bad song.
I just wanted to quickly mention, it was kind of amazing how they really, truly managed to capture that sound.
Yes.
And I'm guessing the audio producer may have been actually probably in the scene themselves.
Yeah, definitely. And what else? I thought all the performances were really, really, really good, especially Megan Fox. I was very impressed by her. She's like very, she holds back, but in a really good way. I don't know how to describe it. It's like not overdone, but it's very natural, restrained, I guess, but in the right way. Restrained in all the right ways. And I think the writing was good. There were moments, like, I'm not a big Juno fan, and there were certainly moments that were like that quirky, cutesy language and like fun little terms, like, oh, he's so salty. That means he's hot. Things like that. I don't know. That sometimes gets under my skin a little bit, but otherwise really good. Good gore. Yeah. Overall, I really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun.
Okay. So, right off the bat, I wouldn't say disagreeing with you, but I agree that it is a pretty Diablo Cody forward movie.
Mm-hmm.
So much in the same way that like you can immediately recognize Aaron Sorkin's writing, Diablo Cody's movies written by her come out there. And I actually do think that's one of the few things that bumped this movie up from spoiler kind of average to slightly above average for me. I think Megan Fox actually fits really well with this style of writing. What I kind of call this really earnest insincerity that she has and those lines that she's given to do. And I think that was the highlight of the movie for me. So kind of the opposite of you. While I do understand how it is a little cringy, I think that's what gives this movie its attitude. And otherwise, I can jump on board with this current trend of recognizing that it was underappreciated, because from a purely anecdotal experience, I can definitely say it was mismarketed, remembering how I was marketed to back in those days, and something I think we'll all talk about.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I don't think it was as memorable as Juno, as an example. And I think I come into this, watching this, this was my first time, knowing that it's part of the zeitgeist again, and because of that, I may have been trying a little too hard to dissect the movie of its themes.
Mm.
Because of that, I felt a little disappointed that it didn't feel as deep or subversive that I was expecting it to be, which may not be fair for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But if I want to be a little bit more harsh about it, like, I do think some of the themes are just weak. Like, we were introduced to something and then kind of pivoted hard away from it at one point. But again, that may be just my preconceived notions about some things that, and all this I think will flesh out in a little bit more, because I do think today's discussion is going to really help me understand and flesh out the movie a little bit more here, especially in this, the feminist empowerment themes that are, that's what makes this part of the conversation. Now, I don't feel like I have a good grasp on what it was trying to say, but it may actually be what it was trying to say. It may not have been as strong as I was expecting it to be, and I did get it. Yeah, so
that's possible.
So I'm not overwhelmed. I'm not underwhelmed. I was just kind of whelmed. Yeah. Not saying it's a bad movie for sure. I definitely enjoyed it, but not blown away. And again, maybe just had too high of expectations going into it.
Yeah. Well, just to start with something like a little more, less like intense, I guess, so less time we'll need to devote to it. Just to talk about Megan Fox's performance for a second. I think what you were saying, like her sincere insincerity.
Her
earnest insincerity. Maybe that's what I meant by her, like the way it felt like a sort of restrained performance, but in a good way. I don't know how else to describe that. But I think that's sort of what, I think what you said about this, say it again.
Earnest insincerity.
Earnest insincerity. I think maybe that's what I was feeling and what I liked, because for a lot of the movie we see Jennifer, Megan Fox, either as the succubus and possessed and therefore like acting sexy and like luring people or threatening Amanda Seyfried's character, or we see her before she's possessed and she's sort of just like this like sexy and cool fun girl who just is like too cool to like care about anything. Right. So she's constantly making little jokes and whatever.
Not necessarily a bad person about it.
No,
either.
Not a, just
we don't,
like
we don't
cool.
see she's a good person, but
yeah, she's just cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, because of that, we don't really get to see beyond that sort of mask she wears, I guess. But then there are scenes where that mask falls off, even when she's possessed, where we see her like crying in bed or like when she's basically like, stunned after this like bar burns down where she gets possessed. Right. She like is very stunned.
Vulnerable,
yeah. Gets taken into the van. And then when she leaves whatever happens to her at the van, we'll talk about that later, and walks to Amanda Seyfried's house or Needy's house. She's very, like, eyes vacant, terrified, or nervous. Well, until she starts scarfing down a chicken.
Right. Traumatized.
But yeah, traumatized. So we see her traumatized, and we see these moments where she is really vulnerable. So I think the way Megan Fox plays these two parts of this one character is what's really good about it. Because even though she is the succubus or the demon for most of the movie, she's still the center of our sympathies and like who we care about, I think, in the movie. Besides Needy too, but I don't know. She just did a really good job of being a sympathetic monster, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. I do definitely believe Megan Fox. I go as far to say carried the movie because I didn't really care. I didn't dislike Amanda Seyfried's performance. I thought it was fine.
Yeah.
I thought someone else in it could have maybe really elevated the movie. Like, I think this was past her age at this point, but, like, thinking about Anne Hathaway as, like, Amanda Seyfried,
yeah.
I think we could have had, like, a really stellar movie.
I was thinking Lindsay Lohan.
Lindsay Lohan's an easy... I think Lindsay Lohan, but that might be because it's an easy comparison to her as Caddy and
Mean Girls. Yeah.
Because there is definitely a lot of parallels with Mean Girls. And not to mention Amanda Seyfried was in Mean Girls.
True.
That's all to say that I totally agree that Megan Fox's performance was really the highlight here.
Yeah, I agree. Those were like my favorite parts of the movie. And when Megan Fox wasn't on screen, it was sort of like, okay, I can't wait for Megan Fox to be back.
And this is the only one of the two movies I have, like, you know, again, this is what the marketing did to me.
Yeah.
And just, I don't know, gossip rags, ease news, or whatever else.
Yeah.
I have low expectations of Megan Fox. And that's sad because she did a wonderful job in this movie. Mm-hmm. I've only ever seen her maybe the first Transformers in the background or something. Other than that, I don't know anything else about her performances or what she's even been in. And I feel sad that I have such low expectations of her. Just because of one of the two movies she's in, she did a stellar job.
Yeah. I think part of this is, I think Transformers came before this pretty close to each other, right?
Were they just a few years apart? Yeah.
Well, no matter what, I know that her performance and her role or whatever in Transformers definitely informed the way that they marketed this movie, like you're saying. But I think just in general, until recently, Megan Fox has been... I mean, even now, it still hasn't been completely turned around.
Yeah.
But Megan Fox really has just been sort of seen as just like a sex object, and it doesn't really matter how she acts. She's just there. And there's a pretty famous quote from Megan Fox. I forget who she said it to, but it was during an interview right around Jennifer's Body, where she says, oh, it's something like, my job isn't to act, it's just to be there so men can look at me. And I feel like that is sort of what we all expected of her, and what probably a lot of people still think of her. But I think that also informed the marketing of this film. Yeah, that's so very flawed. And also the way we maybe all unfairly treated Megan Fox.
So let's talk about the marketing, because, you know, we're deep, knee-deep into this right now. From what I remember, and I, you know, didn't even bother watching Jennifer's Body, because I assumed it was going to be almost like, I don't know, an exploitation film of Megan Fox. Or like Megan Fox was going to be doing this somewhat softcore horror movie, almost porn horror movie. That's what it all felt like to me back in the day, and so I immediately dismissed it. It felt much in the same how, you know, this was marketed as Diablo Cody's sophomore movie after Juno. Even though it might not be her actual second movie, but it's definitely like Juno was the one to put her on the map. Well, same thing with Megan Fox. The Transformer movie put her on the map, and here she is doing something different.
Yeah.
But here she is doing something different, except she's still this piece of meat that you're supposed to just all ogle at.
Right.
And, you know, this whole horror movie is about making googly eyes at Megan Fox. And you know what? It kind of is.
It plays with that.
It not just plays with it. I mean, that's almost a central part of the
plot. But think about this. Like, for a horror movie that's marketed that way, did we ever see any female nudity or boobs or anything?
No.
Isn't that pretty shocking for the way that they marketed this?
Yeah. Well, but that was also part of how they marketed it, where that's why I called it like a softcore horror, where we know
Megan Fox.
I'm always going to mix that up. Megan Fox was not actually going to bare her breasts or anything.
Sure.
But like, we're just going to get, you know, teased by her the entire movie. And that's what this movie was about.
But still, the way they marketed it, because of sort of the tradition of horror film, especially exploitation horror, I feel like you sort of expect at least to see someone's boobs in this movie, if not Megan Fox's. Someone's boobs should be in here, based on how they're marketing it. And the fact that they didn't have that, I think, is why I see this as sort of a play on that. We also get scenes where Megan Fox is purposely meant to look ugly, or as they say in the movie, ugly for her. And then even the kiss. So I remember this part of the marketing. There was a lot of talk of, oh, in this movie, you're going to see Megan Fox kiss Amanda Seyfried, and it's going to be so hot. But even that kiss wasn't really, it didn't feel like it was meant for, like, the straight male audience to enjoy. It was like, confusing and tense and, like, and more horrifying, I guess, than anything. Or, like, not horrifying, but, like, a moment where we know she's a demon. And, like, it's dangerous for Amanda Seyfried to be, like,
it's Amanda
entering
Seyfried
into
kind
this.
Of falling, into down the dark path.
Yeah.
So I'll say, what's funny about all this is that, like, you can't say the marketing was, like, in, like, completely fabricated or inaccurate. Because it was all those things the marketing was says, but not meant for the male gaze, almost.
Right.
It was like, oh, here's a movie where, you know, Megan Fox plays a sex kitten and... You know, we get to see her seduce guys, and we do get to see her kiss Amanda Seyfried. Don't you want to see that? That's whatever. That's the movie. And all that does happen. But it's not like in just like a totally different framing of it.
Well, that's the thing. It got the audience wrong, I think. I think this is a female revenge fantasy film marketed as... I don't know, like exploitation horror for adolescent
horny
teen
boys.
Yeah.
totally.
And that's where they got it wrong, because all those things are in there, but it's not. It's like the tone of it, I guess. Yeah, the audience. It's wrong.
Right. And you know, it's weird too, because we shouldn't. Anybody in the know for like Diablo Cody, who she was, and watching, you know, Juno, should have expected something of that.
Mm-hmm.
And Karen Kursama, who wasn't. I mean, she still kind of is not a household name, I guess.
I guess not. But in horror circles, she is.
Yeah. I mean, because Invitation is such a good... By the way, this movie had... I don't know. I really keep thinking it's a Diablo Cody movie, because I didn't see Kurosawa's imprint at all. Like, I saw no similarities between this and The Invitation at all.
Yeah.
In terms of style or whatever. I mean, there was definitely an attitude and style here. I'm surprised that it belonged to Kurosawa's and as a director. So,
yeah,
sorry,
I mean,
that was a bit of an
aside. No, I think that makes sense, but I also think about the script is so different from The Invitation that I don't think Karen Kursama could have done what she did with The Invitation really here.
It's a totally different script.
I mean, the only thing that I felt was sort of close, and it's because it's close in content, I guess, a little bit, is when the goth kid drives down that empty neighborhood block, because it's all the houses are empty still, and all the lights are off, and he's sort of getting clues that things are a little off, but he proceeds anyway. That felt a little Invitation-y.
Right. That was probably the closest to horror this movie got, in terms of, you know, spreading fear and
I agree. But I got actually a list. Speaking, I think this fits in well. This is from an article from Vox, and they got a list of fun quotes from reviews from 2009 about this movie.
Wait, one last thing before for me about how this was mismarketed. Behind the scenes, I read on IMDb.
Well, we're gonna talk more actually about that too.
Okay,
go on.
You're probably gonna talk about this, Sam, but I'll bring it up now. How Megan Fox was going to be asked by the producers to do a PR stunt where she responds on some like Pornhub on like a live like streaming cam site for porn stars, like do a Q&A on there.
Huh.
And Diablo Cody or Kursama was so like offended by that. She first off turned it down and made sure that Megan Fox never heard that was the case.
Whoa.
Because she thought that was going to really disenfranchise Megan Fox, and it would have. I mean, I feel terrible for like just knowing that like how do they get this so wrong and do something at this point? It seems pretty vile almost.
Yeah.
to really manipulate that situation. But so anyways, just goes to show how crazy different wavelength the marketing and producers are than like the actual artists working on this movie.
Yeah, and you can see it in the poster itself. The poster has very little to do with the actual movie. It's Megan Fox in a cheerleader's uniform. Or no, not in a cheerleader's uniform, but like a mini skirt and like a pretty like small top, I guess, tight and small top. And she's like provocatively leaning or sitting or something on a school desk. And then behind her is a chalkboard that says, "Hell yes." So it doesn't really fit the whole thing anyway. But anyway, so some reviews. So Chicago Tribune says, quote, "It's a gruesome paint by bloody numbers succubus story," unquote. AV Club described it as, quote, "clever for its own sake, a showy piece of writing that doesn't have that all important ballast of sincerity," unquote. LA Times says it was a, quote, "self-conscious splatter over a sorely lackluster scare flick." And while director Karen Kursama was able to generate an old-fashioned sexploitative zing, unfortunately she can't muster up a modicum of suspense elsewhere. And Roger Ebert actually gave them 3 stars for this film. And he didn't think it was that important or interesting, but he said, quote, "as a movie about a flesh-eating cheerleader, it's better than it has to be," unquote. MTV called it brilliant. And then, yeah, but recently things have changed. And recently there was a New York Times article that talked about how this is Diablo Cody's oddest and most intriguing work. And Sci-Fi Wire called it, quote, "still socially relevant." So it's sort of very different response. But even looking at these reviews from 2009, it's not too bad.
No, I didn't think those reviews captured... I think those reviews showed that they were watching... They watched the movie and were giving it, being thoughtful about it. Because I kind of agree that this is not anything super special to me. Aside from Megan Fox's performance, I wasn't blown away. I agree with Roger Ebert the most, who still gave it a pretty good score there for Roger Ebert, and saying that, you know, it's good for what it is, but it's not important to me.
Okay, so here, I guess this is a good time to talk about, I guess, why I think people are saying it's important.
Sure, yeah.
So I think a lot of it has to do with this, who the audience really is for this movie. So again, it was, I think, marketed, and I think you agree, marketed more towards like horny male teenagers. When really it should be marketed to for like a, as a female revenge fantasy. And that's what I think this movie is. I think it was made for female viewers, specifically straight female viewers. And I think too, what's the other? Oh, I think the other issue too, why it maybe wasn't so beloved back then. Also, I think 2009, there probably weren't as many. I feel like most film reviewers were white straight men.
Sure.
So I feel like that probably changes things a little bit too. I think we're getting more voices, especially in like the horror scene. Right.
Well, but for, well, I just want to pause here and say, like, I still don't disagree with any of those reviews.
Yeah, I agree.
So I don't think the reviewers were off pace here. I think it was just the general audiences were.
I think too, like the talking around this movie, at least in the fandom. So maybe not those big reviewers, but like reviewers on horror websites or horror zines or whatever, didn't really love Jennifer's Body. I should have found those quotes.
Okay.
But
okay.
I think the horror, like the horror fandom in general, snubbed Jennifer's Body pretty hard.
And
I think 2009 versus today, there's a lot more female voice out there in like horror circles, I guess. But yeah, I think the big thing is like is the fact that, like you said earlier, it's post Me Too era that we're watching this, which changes things a little. But it doesn't really change things a little. I think it just makes what this movie was about a little more obvious and more on the surface than it would have been back in 2009 to all audiences. I think it's more obvious now to everyone because it's discussed more publicly. It's in the social eye. It's in the zeitgeist, I guess, of 2020 today. Whereas in 2009, probably not many people out, like non-female identifying people would have really been thinking of this in that same way.
Okay.
I think this movie, so just to give a little bit of background for anyone who hasn't seen it. Jennifer, near the beginning of the movie, Jennifer and Needy go to a bar to see this indie rock show. A performance by Low Shoulder, like you said, this like sort of very unknown, pretty unknown, fairly unknown
small time. Generic, but not untalented.
Yeah. Fronted by Adam Brody. And somehow this bar lights up on fire. The whole thing goes down. It's this big traumatizing event. A lot of people die. But our main characters escape. And Adam Brody, like, pretty much forces Megan Fox to drink this drink. And then leads her away into his... what they describe as a creepy rape van, I think, even in the movie. Or like a molester van with blacked out windows. And as much as Needy begs Jennifer to not go in the van, Jennifer goes anyway. And she does seem to be a little bit in a daze. It doesn't really seem like Jennifer is herself. She goes with these guys. We don't learn this until close to the end, what happens to Jennifer. But at the end, it's revealed that what happened was... I mean, obviously they're going for like a rape type situation, and Jennifer even says like, "Please don't rape me. I'll be so bad. I'm a virgin. I don't even know what to do. I don't know what to do." And they're all excited that she's a virgin, even though it turns out she's not, because they need a virgin for the sacrifice they want to do, the satanic sacrifice, to make sure that they are successful and famous.
Right.
But again, she's what?
Neoliberal.
Sure. But it turns out she's not a virgin, and supposedly, according to this movie's logic, what happens if you sacrifice someone in a virgin sacrifice who is not a virgin, you create a succubus. Mm-hmm. And that is Jennifer. So, because of the way this van scene plays out, it's hard not to view this as sort of a Me Too situation, where we see a woman get, let's say, sexually assaulted, mm-hmm. and the men who sexually assault her get pleasure out of this trauma. We even see the guys, they sing that 3, 2, 7, 0, 6, 0, 9, 8. They're having a great time. There's like male bonding going on over her body as they're like hurting her. And then they also get success and admiration and mm-hmm. love. They rise to the ranks after this event. It's hard not to think about like the Kavanaugh trial and I guess Harvey right. Weinstein less so though, because he was already a big deal.
I could definitely feel it mimicking, like, I don't actually remember the outcome of it, but like the Duke lacrosse team comes to the top of mind of like, you know, a bunch of boys crossing the line, obviously.
And then meanwhile, Jennifer, the victim, really becomes monstrous and becomes abject. Like, she becomes more of an outsider because of this thing that happened to her. So again, thinking about the Kavanaugh trial, I forget her name. That's bad. I should have...
The doctor?
Yeah.
It's all right. We'll forgive you.
I apologize. But she, like, she was attacked, not on all sides, but she was attacked too for coming out. So I see the same thing, and especially in 2009, if you were coming out alleging someone, like, assaulted you, for the most part, those women were, like, insulted, attacked, death threats, blah, blah, blah. And here we see Jennifer becomes a succubus. She becomes monstrous as mm-hmm. they rise the ranks and become beloved and things like that. So I really like that. And then again, we have this hidden female revenge fantasy where she's able to take her trauma. She's able to take how they turned her into a monster and like kill and attack. And it's awesome. And yeah.
So I don't think I missed anything, but here's where I would put this as like a flaw in this theory. And I'm not saying like your theory's dumb, because mm-hmm. I think this is where it was going. Yeah. But like, she's not properly dealing with trauma. And like, she is not really a victim in the movie at all.
I disagree because of what the van scenario. I think.
Yeah, but then she like becomes powerful and loves it. Mm-hmm. She like loves her abilities afterwards. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't show that she's suffering from that, right? It almost you could even interpret it as these guys gave her power. These guys did her a favor.
Well, okay, one thing I think, the fact that she wasn't constantly killing the whole time, and I think we do see a few moments where she is like a little upset about what she has to do. Like when she confides in Needy.
Right.
It does seem like she doesn't want to kill, but she has to, and she's sort of stuck.
She isn't wanting about it.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, I think that's part of this, like, whole revenge fantasy. It's this fantasy of becoming, like, sort of overcoming and becoming stronger because of what you've been through. Like, not letting yourself be a victim and actually being able to fight back. And again, using that traumatic experience, I guess, through that traumatic experience, she's able to come into her own. She's not just shuffled to the side and hurt by it.
Right.
She's angry.
Sure, but that doesn't, like, I still don't see then how it's in the line of, like, Me Too. It's definitely a revenge, mm-hmm. but it's not even a revenge fantasy, because it's hard to make a revenge fantasy if she's not going to be your protagonist.
I think she is a protagonist, though.
I don't know about that.
I think she is, because I think because we sympathize with her, because I think this movie places her right in this the central focus of sympathy. Maybe not the central, but she is she's not the protagonist. I think the protagonist is Needy.
Of course, yeah.
But I think Jennifer is in this like place of both spectacle and sympathy, and because of that, we do, again, sympathize with her. More than anyone she kills. That's the other thing, too. We don't really care about, except for Needy's boyfriend, we don't care about anyone, really, that she kills.
The three people she does kill on screen, mm-hmm. the movie doesn't set them up to deserve it. at all. So, like, I don't know how much... I sympathize with her overall plight, especially how she became the succubus, right?
Yeah.
But then her actions afterwards, I don't think are sympathetic. I don't think she does anything of worth being sympathy whatsoever after the fact. And that's where I have this kind of disconnect between what this movie was trying to say.
Well, okay, so I think you're right. I don't think that, like, obviously killing is bad, right? And none of those guys that she kills really necessarily does anything really wrong that we see.
She comes on to, first of all, okay, let's talk about each one individually. Sure. The first one is, like, best friends with some people who died.
He's on the football star.
Yeah, he's like the football star. His friends, played by Chris Pratt, by the way, for a very short cameo, mm-hmm. died in this first bar burning scene.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just crying, minding his own business, and was apprehensive throughout when Megan Fox comes on to him very hard. And, you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say she rapes him because, you know, he's definitely into it too at some point.
She lures him.
She lures him. So, you know, he doesn't do anything that Weinstein-esque at all.
No. None of them do.
Yeah. So the second guy...
Except for Adam Brody.
Yeah, except for Adam Brody. And the second guy is just some emo kid who decides to take a shot, and she says, yeah, sure, let's go for it. And he's, you know, thrilled about it, of you know, who wouldn't be, right? He doesn't do anything shady. He doesn't do anything worth sneering at. She kills him. He dies a gruesome death. And then we got Chip, who is Needy's boyfriend, and who, you know, by all other metrics, he's a good guy. Throughout the movie, he is, like, you know, someone who's sincere, who's concerned. Maybe he's a little dismissive, and maybe we can ding him for that a little bit, because, you know, Needy, this is the time Needy's like, oh, she's a demon. He's mm-hmm. like, you're whatever.
Yeah, and
you're
then crazy. He gets told, oh, Needy's cheating on you, and he's like, oh, that must be true.
Well, but still. Okay, so maybe towards the end there, yeah, a little mm-hmm. bit. But, like, so none of these boys deserved it.
Okay, I agree, but here's the flip of this. I think you need to look at this movie, for this reason at least, not within its, like, narrative, but in what it does with the horror genre. And what I mean by that is, actually, this is, I'm sort of pulling a little bit from a recent article on Horror Homeroom, and if you don't know Horror Homeroom, I highly check it out. This article was written by Sarah McCartney, and it's on the figure of the girl monster.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, other examples of the girl monster are Carrie, Reagan from The Exorcist, Ginger mm-hmm. Snaps, and then the female characters in Raw and Teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's Jennifer's Body is a perfect example, so I feel like I don't really have to define it too much. But check out that article if you're interested. But one thing that I think is interesting here is when we have a girl monster, usually, and definitely in this case, the victims are all male, which is totally different from usual horror films. Usually, the bulk of the victims are women.
Mm-hmm.
And even when we have male victims, the camera's not as interested in their death scenes. The camera is far more interested in death scenes of women. And I think this movie is having a really fun time with these male victims. Just like in a slasher film, usually it's just the sin, quote-unquote, of having sex, doing drugs, or drinking. And we never have these conversations with those female victims, really. I guess it's just assumed that no one really deserves to die. But I think here it really was just like, well, I guess there's the sex thing with all three of them. Yeah, all three of them wanted to have sex. They never got to. But I think all three of them, their quote-unquote sin here is being a guy.
Yeah.
And I think that's the logic of the film. And I think that's the film sort of having fun with the horror genre. And typically in a slasher, we have, again, these, like, sort of outdated, pretty conservative moral codes that we all agree with, or at least, like, accept, I guess. Not agree with, but we accept them as horror fans watching the movie. Like, you know, Scream. You laugh along when Jamie Kennedy is like, uh-oh, don't say you'll be right back, because mm-hmm. that means you're gonna die, or don't have sex, we're in a horror movie. And here it's like, don't be a guy, because Jennifer's gonna get you.
Right, right. She's like the boogeyman of the town at one point. Almost.
So, and what I, and the other thing too I want to talk about briefly is comparing this to the 2019 Black Christmas, mm-hmm. where we had to make all men evil.
Right.
Which sucked. And I like how this movie, it didn't make all men evil,
right.
but it did still set have this like female revenge fantasy where like, yeah, they're not all evil, but they're all gonna die because of what one of you did, and I'm pissed off.
Okay, so here's what I'll say about all this. Like, I can see, and this is not a new revelation for me, but like, I understand how it can be seen as subverting the expectations of a female monster, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where we can just have, this is my where you just might where you might disagree that an unsympathetic female monster who's just killing men,
mm-hmm.
and how that pushes the boundaries and makes it progressive in general.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily think it's female empowerment to do that. I think it's
no,
progressive,
it's a fantasy,
but not empowerment.
Though. It's a fantasy. I don't think it's empowerment either. I think it's a female fantasy.
Okay. So, but so I'm saying it is shifting the scales a little bit in a direction where we want to be for equality or for just, you could even say broadly empowerment, but...
Or even representation, because it's nice to see, it's really nice to watch a horror movie where I don't, like, where it's not, like, women being primarily threatened.
That's the best
really
word,
nice.
I think, for this. Representation. It's good representation. I don't quite see where it falls in line for supporting the Me Too movement. Like, I don't see how we're supposed to see her being justified to do what she does based on a Me Too-esque issue she went through.
I think it's less than, not quite supporting it, but more representing it. Mm-hmm. And I think in 2009 to be representing this issue is really remarkable. To show this like instance of some sort of sexual violent trauma, whatever happened in the van, however you want to read that. And then ending the movie with this death of the band, even though... This is my one complaint, that Jennifer didn't get to kill that band, mm-hmm. and also that it wasn't a scene, it was just, like, crime scene photographs at the end.
Right.
I wish we could have really...
But that's what I'm saying, like, there's no comeuppance for the direct event that happened to her. And that's where I could say, like, a Me Too movement, like, can co-opt this as part of, like, you know, this is part of our message here. Well, not message, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know... Part of the...
It's a representation of an issue,
but,
I think.
So how can
this.
You say something like Last House on the Left is not a better representation of that? Where it is a female who was gang raped, who directly is becoming a monster, but also not just a sympathetic monster, but like the hero for killing the men who did it to her directly.
Because I don't think... So, two things. In that movie, she doesn't necessarily become a monster ever. Certainly not literally, but I think even watching the movie, I don't think you're supposed to think...
That's true. I'm maybe forgetting the movie. It's not like she becomes very powerful.
Yeah.
She's almost actually pretty shitty as a killer.
And then the other thing is, that one doesn't have this, like, rise to success or rise to fame or, like, public beloving or public admiration that Adam Brody and his band get. That's what I think this movie really taps into, being turned into, being abjected from society as a result of your trauma. Like, being abjected because you were raped or sexually assaulted or whatever, you're made a monster, whereas you're, the assailant is... successful and famous and beloved by everyone. That's why I think this representation for 2009 is remarkable for that reason, I think.
So let me go on this is might derail the conversation, but it's a direction I want to take it in, because we keep on talking about the term trauma. We brought it up multiple times now. I was actually thinking this movie... So you know I came into this movie blind.
Yeah.
I barely even really knew that it was talked about in the lens of feminist theory. And I can see now the representation thing. I still don't really believe that Me Too stuff.
Okay.
But I thought this was a movie about trauma. I thought everything was a metaphor for... Not female trauma either, necessarily. Well,
I mean, that's,
female trauma too.
Yeah.
But like, I thought she was feeding off of... like the town's trauma and feeding off of this, not, I don't want to say it's insincerity of a town, but basically of a community's grasping of coming together from this fake sense of community brought on by trauma.
Yeah.
I don't want to say fake as in, you know, they're all pretending, but it is somewhat arbitrary based on an event. I thought that's what this movie was about. I thought she fed off of that. And I think the movie goes out of its way multiple times to kind of push in that direction really strong. Mm-hmm. Like one thing that stuck in my mind, for example, she orders the 9/11 shot, which is a red, white, and blue shot. But if you let it sit for too long, it turns into shit. Brown.
Yeah.
Like, and it was very in your face. Like, and there was a couple of other lines in there where it was very much in your face of how she, like, you know, everybody's crying because people died. Boo-hoo for them.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Fuck that. Whatever.
Yeah. I think there was even another 9/11 joke somewhere in there.
Yeah. So I thought all of this was about, like, how people become, how we need trauma in our lives to fuel us a little bit. But then I thought it pivoted hard away from that in the last act of the movie and didn't follow up with that at all. So I think, to me, after talking about this through, I'm not convinced that my initial reactions, that the themes were not as strong as at least I wanted them to be, or as clearly thought out and as clever as I wanted to be, are actually there. I think not just a strong movie in that sense.
Well, I think you're right, though, because there was, I forget if it was with Kusama or Cody, but one of them said in an interview that part of what they wanted to do with this movie was talk about, like, what happens if you're not responding to traumatic events in the same way as, like, the community says, like, you're supposed to react in this way, and we're all backing low shoulder, so if you don't like low shoulder, then you're not a patriot, or whatever. So they said that's part of it, trauma was part of it, and then also this idea of, like, girl-on-girl hate a little bit, too, which you definitely see between Needy and Jennifer.
That's where I was talking about where it pivoted the last third, where it became kind of like Mean Girls.
Yeah, but it's interesting, though, because I think to make their relationship the most important and interesting one and complex one in this whole movie is another point of, like, this clearly wasn't meant for the audience they marketed it to. It's clearly meant for women, because they do have this really complex relationship where, as much as they, like, they sort of are mean to each other, Needy and Jennifer, they still are dependent on each other. And it's clearly, Jennifer and Needy clearly care about each other right up until the end when Needy kills Jennifer. Even then, there is, like, this love there, I guess.
Yeah.
So I think that's, I don't know, I don't have anything necessarily to say about that, but I think that's there, too. I think they're investigating or exploring a lot of different themes that maybe clouded up the works a little bit.
I think so. I kind of like Joker, what Joker did, and that was my big criticism of Joker.
What?
Too many.
I thought you were saying you kind of liked what Joker did.
Oh, no, no. I don't like this. I dislike Joker, and I don't like dislike Jennifer's body. But based on this resurgence of popularity, I am still pretty disappointed. Not disappointed is a strong word, but let down by how smart this movie was overall. It was clever at times, and it was good in other places, but I don't think overall it's a smart movie. I don't think it, it's deserving of a reanalysis and resurgence just based on the mismarketing at the beginning, but it's not something that I think we need to be broadcasting to the world. It's completely underrated.
But we are broadcasting it to the world.
I'm not. But I'm not.
You're making this podcast, though.
Yeah, but I'm telling them on the podcast that it is not an underappreciated movie. Robert Ebert gave it 3 stars back in the day. That's more than I think I would have given it.
Really? Well, we'll see that in a second. But I think bringing up Roger Ebert, I do think that's the thing. I think this is, it's got one foot in, like, campy teen horror and the other foot in, I don't know what, like, wanting to be something bigger or wanting to, or like a smart commentary film, I guess.
Right.
Can we, like, I don't know what genre that is, but it's sort of wading the waters of both. It has sort of a similar tone to, like, Cabin in the Woods, maybe, where it does have this sort of campy exterior, like, sensibility about it, but it is there trying to, or at least trying to do something smart with the genre it's working within. Which I really like. I really like Cabin in the Woods too. And I don't know. There was something else I wanted to talk about briefly too with this Horror Homeroom article, and also why we might look at Jennifer's monstrousness as something positive. So Kristeva, this theorist, she has this theorist about the abject body, which is basically any body that's impure, unsocialized, out of control, taboo. Typically, Kristeva says abjection is usually female, figured as female. And Barbara Creed, another theorist, picked up on this, and she connected it directly to horror films. And she said that abjection, and talking about The Exorcist in particular here, and possession films, and why women tend to be the possessed figure in possession films, abjection is rebellion of lusty, filthy female flesh. And that's why we often have things like cannibalism, the black goo coming out of Jennifer's mouth a few times. Also, Jennifer has a line that ties her monstrosity directly to her sexuality and to her female body. When she has blood all over her, she jokingly asks Needy, "Oh, do you have a tampon?" Mm-hmm. So there's like this direct connection to her between her monstrosity and her sexuality there, but also in the ways that she lures her victims with her sexuality, sure. And literally with Jennifer's body.
Succubus, yeah.
Yeah. But she's still an appealing figure, and maybe this is how we can connect it back to this female revenge fantasy. She's still an appealing figure because of her abjection. She gets to sort of exist beyond and outside of traditional femininity and like what is allowed. So she gets to be sort of this sexy girl without being like dumb slut girl. Mm-hmm. Instead, she's like powerful, sexy monster, funny girl. So I think there's something like pretty liberating in that sense too, and what she does with what happens to her. She gets to be the one in, like, rather than sex being a crime that you're killed for in a slasher film, here her sex is her power.
Okay. I don't know. Maybe I'm watching too many movies after this. It just doesn't seem that unique to me that we need as a culture to revisit and reappreciate this movie back in this day. I think there's a lot of examples of that, probably some before then.
That's what this whole article is about, that the girl monster is in a lot of films, but is a figure that's not really talked about too much for whatever reason.
Well, I can say to start wrapping up our final thoughts here, that I can understand how this should be referenced in these types of articles and pointed to and stuff like that. Overall, I still I'm not convinced that this movie is super smart. I differentiate between something being smart and something being clever. And there's definitely moments of it being clever. Mm-hmm. But overall, I don't think it contributes a whole lot into intellectual framework and theory. But I still had fun with it. I enjoyed Diablo Cody's writing. So if you enjoy that, then I think, you know, you'd be a fan of this movie. I also, we didn't talk about this at all, and we don't have time to talk about it, but I kind of enjoyed Diablo's. She's got this self-loathing about liking alternative culture and like culture. And I definitely feel that at times. Yeah. It's like sometimes I'll roll my eyes and internally call myself such a stupid hipster for liking things. And I think that she does that too, and she addresses it, and I like that. But yeah, overall, it's good. Definitely underappreciated, 100%, from when it came out in 2009. Was it underrated? I'm not so sure about that. But 100% it was underappreciated.
Okay. So what's your final rating then? And what are we rating it out of?
Tampons to suck up gore? Can't think of anything.
Yeah, there wasn't really like a proper image, I guess. Unless we want to talk about the black goo.
Yeah, we could do black goo, but is it the same black goo from Black Christmas? Who knows?
Oh, gosh.
But, okay, let's go with tampons.
All right.
6.2 bloody tampons.
I really liked it. I had a lot of fun watching it. That's what I liked about this too, again, to compare to the 2019 Black Christmas. This one was like a lot of fun to watch. It wasn't hitting you over the head as much as we were talking about potential subtext right. here. You could enjoy this movie without thinking about sort of this Me Too or feminist subtext at all, and you could just enjoy it as a pure horror film.
Yeah.
It never took itself too seriously, which I really appreciated. And again, great performances. This is what I think 2019 Black Christmas was going for.
Yeah.
And yeah, I really enjoyed it. I always have a hard time giving numbers to things. I'll give it 8.5 bloody tampons.
Okay. Pretty good score there. Mm-hmm. And you know what? What is a very interesting comparison piece to Black Christmas, because mm-hmm. I'd much rather watch this somewhat blurred and understated themes than whatever Black Christmas was trying to do with the mm-hmm. same exact themes, kind of.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it felt like an after-school special, Black Christmas. Yeah. And this felt like a horror film.
And it definitely makes sense why it's one of our lowest rated episodes mm-hmm. or movies that we've covered.
Yes.
Okay, so I think there's some nifty conversations here.
Definitely.
About Jennifer's Body. And I'm glad we definitely watched it so we can understand what people are talking about. And now I am curious to check out Ginger Snaps.
Maybe that could be our next movie. I don't know. We haven't decided on a next movie, but we'll let you know what it is on Twitter. Which, speaking of Twitter, you should follow us on Twitter. We're NOTL Academic Pod. Chat with us. Let us know what movies you want us to cover, because that would be very helpful for us. Let us know what you thought about Jennifer's Body. And please rate and review us on iTunes. That's very helpful to get our podcast discovered.
Okay. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.